So I used to talk to myself alone in a British accent sometimes.
Why?
I don't know. I think it made me feel like something I wasn't.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And what, you're, what, 39?
I'll be 40 in the summer.
You probably, I would assume, came to Harry Potter a little late by the nature of your experience as well. I would assume that in the Hasidic community, it's like so far.
It wouldn't have been talked about.
Yeah, it doesn't even matter, right? Like, yeah. It's so, they wouldn't even know to like say, you can't read this.
It happened because my father had 10 siblings. I had one aunt who married out of Williamsburg, by mm-hmm. which I mean she married in Bar Park. Bar mm-hmm. Park was like the next place yes. over, the next enclave over. And Bar Park was considered modern because people dressed in Ferragamo and went out to restaurants and stuff like that. And the kids were allowed to go to a sort of private library where like the books were approved. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up seeing the first Harry Potter book lying around at my cousin's. I was like, what is that? Yeah. Are you allowed to read that? And like their parents were more permissive. And I was like, I have to get my hands on it.
You're listening to Airlift from Berlin Review. I'm Lauren Euler. Today, I'm talking to Deborah Feldman, a writer based in Berlin. Her first book, The Memoir Unorthodox, was published in 2012 and was made into a TV series by Netflix in 2020. In it, she describes in detail her upbringing in the Hasidic community in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, as well as her ultimate decision to leave it. Within a few years, Feldman became a fixture in the German media, and since the October 7th attacks in Israel and the beginning of the war in Gaza, she has been an energetic and outspoken critic of Israel and Germany's financial, political, and generally obsessive support of the country. Her new essay, For the Love of Jews, was published in the new issue of the Berlin Review. The essay is both a historical overview of German philo-Semitism, what Feldman calls, quote, fetishized compassion for Jews, as well as a personal reckoning with her own feelings and role as a Jew who lives in Germany.
You know, I left the Hasidic community in 2009, mm-hmm. and I just didn't feel like I was ever going to be okay in the U.S., like I was ever going to belong anywhere or be accepted for who I was. And I was in Berlin by chance in the summer of 2013, and it was an adventurous summer, and I met a lot of people, but I was really surprised to run into a lot of formerly Orthodox Jews. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them were Israelis. Mm-hmm. They were coming from places like B'nai Barak or the settlements near Jerusalem. But also plenty of them were from European communities like London, Antwerp, Zurich, with some New Yorkers as well. And I realized that it's got this thriving underground where people who are sort of runaways feel like they can arrive and belong immediately. And it was another ex-Orthodox friend of mine who kind of convinced me to get my German citizenship and come here. I moved to Berlin totally without a plan, and I actually wasn't going to play the Jew card. That was then the decision I made,
yeah,
to not do that, but to kind of like just be a Berliner. And it was 2014, and it was still a really nice time to be in Berlin. And then I ended up meeting this very small indie publisher that was technically based in Zurich, but actually out of a one-room apartment around the corner from me in Neukölln. And some way or another, he discovered that I was an American Jewish writer and I'd written this bestseller. And he read it and he had some friends of his read it. And they were like, you have to translate it. And he was like, why isn't it translated yet? And I said, well, Simon & Schuster did bring it to the Frankfurt Book Fair in 2012. And all of the big German houses said, we can't touch that. That's anti-Semitic.
Okay.
So, like, I had just kind of written Germany off as weird. Mm-hmm. And he was like, no, we're going to do this. Like, he bought the rights for basically nothing because Simon & Schuster had given up on the German market. And he translated it himself. And then when the time came, he was like, okay, we need to get PR. We need interviews. We need reviews. And it kind of sort of started to very slowly snowball from there. Mm-hmm. And maybe a month later, I was in German TV for a couple of minutes in the morning news. And a few months later, I was one of the biggest talk shows. And like the pub date, I think, was February. By June, I was number 4, I think, in the bestseller list. And it sort of stayed on the bestseller list for a very long time. And it made me quite well-known in the literary scene, but not popular in the way I became later, which was when the Netflix series was released. That was like a huge popularity boom. So during the time when I was just sort of known as a writer, I noticed that you know, my life was getting very cushy.
Yeah.
You know, I was getting paid like really handsomely to just show up and talk about Jewishness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people really loved me, and they loved me in a way that I thought was strange. Like, it was a needy kind of love. Mm-hmm. Like, they wanted something from me, and I often felt very overwhelmed by it. And I actually would try to address it sometimes, like when I would go to readings, and my interlocutors would sort of laugh uncomfortably and like look past it or ignore it. And so I started to realize that I'm not really like a person in the eyes of all of these people who are consuming me as an idea. I'm an object. And I felt fetishized. And I told myself for a long time, like, listen, it's better than what was in the U.S. In the U.S., you felt like nobody could deal with you the way you were. Here, they love you just the way you are, and they don't want you to be anything else. They don't want you to change. They want you to be just this way. And I was confused about that, because I thought, okay, this is acceptance. This is the best I'll ever achieve. This is arriving.
Can I ask what you mean by you thought you weren't going to be accepted for who you were in the U.S., like where, like in New York City, like beyond the Hasidic community? Like, what do you mean exactly? I mean, I don't live there either.
I went everywhere. What? I went everywhere. I went to New Orleans. I went to California. I went to Chicago. I went to Texas. Mm-hmm. I looked everywhere for a place where I wasn't a weirdo.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a weirdo. I didn't grow up with a Western education. I remember in my first class in college, there was this guy who was actually like really big in the music scene, and he like dropped Mick Jagger in like one of his questions. And I was like, who's Mick Jagger? And he's like, did you grow up in a cave? And I was embarrassed. Like, and this happened all the time. People would look at me like I was a freak, and they would judge me. They would judge me because I had the wrong design on the back pockets of my jeans, because my jeans were cut wrong. And they projected all of these conclusions onto me that felt so quick and so unfair. I just thought, I'm never going to be like good enough in the eyes of other people here. I'm never going to be cool. I'm never going to have any of their cultural references. I'll never have watched the right movies or listened to the right music. And I gave up. Like, I was just like, this is never going to happen for me anyway. So I'm just going to retreat back into this little shtetl fantasy. Mm-hmm. Like, I am the girl from the shtetl. I'm going to milk it for all it's worth.
Here in Germany, you mean?
Here in Germany, yeah.
Yeah, and so the piece also, you kind of, can you talk a little bit about how you came to notice this strange philo-Semitic tendency in German culture?
So it's complex, and it's a sliding scale, and the sliding scale will start somewhere like, you know, this is the publisher of Zorkamp changing her name from Ursula Schmidt to Ulla Berkovich, right? Or somebody like, I think her name is Christine in real life, Thea Dorn. Mm-hmm. She named herself after Theodor Adorno, although she claimed she didn't understand any of his works. Like, it starts sort of with this embrace of a Jewishness that is solely a German cliche.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that can perform this cliche, this acceptable version of Jewishness that Germans find funny, entertaining, but also a confirmation of all their biases, kind of gets rewarded. And that's why I was getting rewarded, because in a way I was confirming bias.
Right.
And there are actually different authentically Jewish people in Germany who've played that role over time. Like, there's someone like Marcel Reich-Ranitzky, who I think in his own time was actually very challenged, but has come to have a legacy similar to that of Heinrich Heine in Germany, as this like very Jewish critic, very biting, very sardonic. And then you have someone like Michael Friedman. You know, he was one of the first Jews I was told about when I got here. And the first thing that was explained to me, he's the Skandal Jude. He's the scandal Jew. Why? Because apparently way back before I arrived, he had gotten caught doing cocaine with trafficked Ukrainian prostitutes. Mm-hmm. And he has this incredible platform. He's the most like popular Jew in Germany. I wouldn't say the most beloved, but the most popular. And I remember thinking, like, how can it be? How can it be that a person who took advantage of trafficked women, how does that person end up being so popular and so well-liked on stages? And I started wondering about Germans being sort of really comfortable with the idea of a Jew that confirms very anti-Semitic prejudices. And at the same time, confirms that they themselves are no longer guilty of those prejudices, because especially in the case of Michael Friedmann, he's the son of Jews who were rescued by Schindler. So his life story is a confirmation of the good Germans. But he himself, you know, is known for his bad behavior.
Right.
And that shows you how even Jewish people can sort of meet the needs of a German audience. And then also how this is attractive for Germans who are so invested in Jewishness that they want to also be a part of the embodiment of it. And you have individual stories of this. You have headlines every couple of years of somebody who faked being a Jew for personal reasons. Maybe they profited from it in their social lives. Maybe they even profited from it in their career. But it's often just very individual psychoses, you could say, or neuroses.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you have something more interesting, something systemic, which is what I get at in the essay. You realize that there are these very powerful institutions, Jewish institutions in Germany. They're funded by the German government to the tune of millions and millions of euros. And I realized that these institutions were largely run by people who had converted. And when I say converted, even these conversions were very sketchy. I mean, right. the most powerful rabbi in Germany between 1997 and 2022 was Rabbi Walter Hamolka, who I talk about in this piece because I think he's so exemplary and he was at the center of the system. And his whole story of like how he converted, you know, it changed over the years. And then when he finally settled on a version of that story, it was a very unusual conversion story for Jewish people. And then his ordination apparently was very unconventional and not recognized by any council of rabbis, neither here nor in the US. And then he becomes the most powerful rabbi. And of course, the Jewish community objects. There's this really famous letter from Michael Fürst that I think was written in 1998 to the Bundestag, where he's protesting to the Bundestag that they've appointed this charlatan, he calls him, as a rabbi. And he says, you know, this person is neither a rabbi nor a Jew. He just has a lust for power that is not normal. And of course, it makes me wonder, you know, this lust for power, it's exactly what Germans have always believed about Jews. And here comes a German, embodies Jewishness in such a way that fulfills anti-Semitic expectations.
Yeah, I think in the piece you say that he seemed to define Jewishness as the preternatural desire to, quote, lead the world and, quote, shape global events. Right.
I heard him say that. I was invited to an event right after I arrived in Germany at the end of 2014. And he shows up and he's like, do you guys know what it means to be Jewish? You know, it means, because he was talking to students who were studying at his college, who were going to go on to be like influential figures, like, you are going to be the leaders of the world. You are going to shape history. And I was like, wow, like, why didn't the rabbis ever tell me that? You know,
I think the question that this sort of like that the essay goes to, and also that I wonder a lot about, you know, what does it mean to be Jewish? You have a couple of different definitions of it in the piece, and there, you know, people can say one thing, people can say another thing, but actually, you know, it seems like quite hard to define, mm-hmm. Particularly, and this issue of conversion makes that like kind of like highlights that, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, like people are converting privately, like, shouldn't you encourage that, right? Yeah. Or should, you know, doesn't, you know, just but I guess, like, I don't want to ask you just straightforwardly, like, how do you define Jewishness?
No,
because
Jew.
it's a difficult question. Yeah, but you should
ask it.
Okay, how, what is it?
So actually, all of this grew out of a very, very early version of that question that I asked myself, right? Because I left Hasidic Judaism behind and I thought, okay, that's it, right? It's over. I checked out some other versions. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to fit in with the Sephardim and I'm not going to fit in with the Libs. You know, like, no one's going to accept me anyway. So it's over for me, right? I'm just going to be a person. Great. And then I was like, oh, well, like, Germany doesn't want you to be a person. They want you to be a Jew. And so what kind of Jew are you now, right? And I started thinking about these things years and years ago. And I realized that I'm not alone. Like, Jews have been having an identity crisis for decades. Jewishness feels completely overshadowed by the memory of the Holocaust, as well as Zionism. It doesn't feel like there's that much beyond those two central pillars for people to really personally draw from as a source of strength and spirituality or identity. And I thought a lot about the embodiment, you know, of Jewishness by sort of opportunistic actors in Germany. And I related it to stories of pretendians I was reading about in the U.S., people who are pretending to be Native American. And I realized that this is what happens when an identity is ravaged, when people almost disappear, you know, when people's idea of themselves is nearly destroyed. Other people get to hijack it. And it's a sign of vulnerability. And I realized that German philo-Semitism is, one, the continuity of German anti-Semitism. It's sort of the continuation of the attempt to erase and to displace Jewishness as it really was and is from Europe. And it's also a sign that Jewishness cannot defend itself, that it doesn't have a strong enough sense of self, and a strong enough presence to defend itself against phenomena like the pretendians.
Yeah.
So I, you know, when I first met all of these converts that I met in Berlin, I adored them. They were very welcoming to me. I remember I would go to these like evenings where they would discuss the Torah like very earnestly amongst each other. And I found it kind of funny and like overly serious. And I would come in with my like midrashim, which are like these sort of like folklore and Talmudic stories and stuff like that. And they were all very like unnerved by it because they had this systemic approach to their studies. And I grew up with a very Talmudic approach to studying and thought, which is elliptical and associative and tangential and so on. But I liked them because I felt like they respected the identity and they wanted to do it justice. And it was later that I realized that if you only have converts in a community, you know, and the people who grew up with Jewishness are this tiny minority, we become the threat and the outsider, and they become the people that define.
They being like converts or like
casual. Yeah. The thing about it is when a religion is practiced in a way that is healthy and there is an established community, converts come in and they can participate and they can even contribute, but they cannot sort of take it over because they're just a member of a larger pre-existing community. And that's why conversion works when there's an existing community. In Germany, that community was erased or displaced. And so you have all these converts. And as I mentioned in the piece, you have this woman named Avital Gerstetter, who is the cantor in the Central Synagogue in Berlin, who's complaining like, wait a second, everyone around me is a convert. I feel like Judaism as practiced here is a whole new religion. I don't recognize it. And she was fired for this complaint, right? Because her boss, the rabbi, was a convert. And she said, listen, the congregation consists mostly of converts and they can't trust you if you have a thing against converts. So out goes the Jewish person born Jewish. So the rest of the converts in the congregation don't feel offended.
Well, I think, you know, like conversely, right? Like if you think about your experience growing up in the Hasidic community in Williamsburg, right? No one, I think, meant most people who are not conservative already would say like that is the only real Jewish experience, of course. But people would also be very hesitant. I'm sure you yourself would be very hesitant to say like, that's not a Jewish experience. It's also a very Jewish experience, right? But it's a very anomalous, very particular Jewish experience. And I think probably a lot of people listening, correct me if I'm wrong, it's religious anti-Zionism, right? Like it's not a Zionist. Like
rabbinic Jews have, from the very first moment that they were constituted as a movement in exile, they were anti-Zionist by default because they believed that they had been punished, rightfully so, for the sins that led to the destruction of the temple, sins they defined as, in a sense, worse than the worst biblical sins. What was the sin? The sin was senseless hatred, infighting. And they believed that, you know, they had earned their exile and they were to sort of work off their sins in exile and one day they would be redeemed. And so there's this, you know, Maimonides wrote the 13 principles of Jewish faith. And the most famous one, the one I know by heart, is Ani ma'amin be'emunah shelemah b'viat ha-mashiach. I believe with a complete faith in the coming of the Messiah. And even though he tarries, I shall wait for him. And why is this important? Because the word wait, it sort of encompasses all of rabbinic Judaism. The idea is we wait for the Messiah. We do not accelerate his coming. We do not force it. And yes, the Satmars, which is, I would say, the largest Hasidic sect, they are part of this tradition. They did not invent the idea of anti-Zionism. They simply held on to it. The reason why we now look at anti-Zionism as, you know, the lifestyle that I grew up in as strange is because at some point in the 30s, a rabbi who lived in Jerusalem came up with this idea of how to reconcile Zionism with Orthodox Judaism. And he said, you know, Orthodox Jews can support the Zionists and see them as a tool in God's plan. And he was considered a heretic for saying this. He died actually in ignominy. I think he had a very small following. He died in the 30s and everyone forgot about him and he was sort of written off as a heretic. But then his son kind of took his ideas and went further with them. And then after the Six-Day War, he turned a lot of religious people who had been non-Zionists into Zionists, and he turned a lot of Zionists who were not religious into religious Zionists. And, you know, you would call someone like that an accelerant. And so this is what happened to Judaism. It's what happened to Christianity. It's also, by the way, what happened to Islam. You have accelerants. For hundreds of years, they've been propelling geopolitics because they translate faith into action. And I look back at my own childhood. I look back at the way that my grandfather and the way that the men in my family and the men in my community sort of kept reading and interpreting those texts and how committed they were to this, even though the Messiah may tarry, I shall wait. It's a decision to choose faith over violence, over conflict, over tension, and it's a decision to choose God over the material world. And I have to admit that in the last few years, I have come to appreciate this heritage in a very new way that I never thought I would, and I feel really connected to it, and I feel grateful for it. And then I think about all the people who don't have that. You know, the people who all they have is the Holocaust or Zionism, and they don't have what I have. And then I think, of course, they feel like Judaism isn't something they can define. It's not something they can put their finger on, and they're happy for people to come and say, I know what it is, and I'll tell you.
When you see these kind of scandals, when people reveal, like, oh, I thought I was Jewish, and I went around town saying I was Jewish, but it turns out I'm not Jewish, or, like, you know, these conversion cases where it's, like, one parent is kind of Jewish, maybe, like, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, and then they convert, but the conversion process is kind of lax, and, you know, whatever. But I wondered also if there's, like, a generous way to interpret this kind of behavior, like, not as mere psychosis. Obviously, it depends on the individual case, but is there, like, a positive way of thinking about Judaism and what people, particularly Germans, but it's not exclusive to Germans, like, what people want to participate in that is not just kind of defined by, like, the current war, the current situation, Zionism, et cetera?
So I draw a really strong distinction anyway between individuals who embrace a Jewish identity for very personal social reasons and individuals who do so in order to exploit a situation, in order to achieve power over others, in order to access institutional influence, political capital, and so on. And that's why I'm like, if you look at someone like Wolfgang Seibert or Walter Homolka, these are people who had offices. They held offices and they had power and they had money and they wielded that power and that money and that capital over Jewish lives and over Jewish fate. And when I look at the individuals in my life, and really they're actually quite many. I mean, one of the first things that happened to me when I moved to Germany was a person in my life revealed themselves to me as Jewish and gave me a name and an identity and a story that was fake. And he did that because he didn't think I'd ever get to know the real story. I was just coming from New York and I was completely naive. And why would I think someone would be lying about being Jewish, right? It would seem ridiculous. So something really weird ended up happening, which is that I once then was in a situation where I was in the same room with this person as with the person he went to school with. And I knew both people. And I was like, oh, you didn't tell me you went to school with a Jewish person. Like, you told me you didn't know any Jews. And he was like, what are you talking about? Which Jews? And so the whole thing sort of came to a head. And it was my first experience. And I remember I felt bad for that person. I felt sorry. Like, I thought, what must it be like to be so uncomfortable with your own given identity that you're willing to, yeah, you're willing to nullify it, erase it? I mean, it was exactly the mirror of what I had just gone through. I came from this Hasidic community and I felt like I was under pressure to fit in and be something that I wasn't. And I thought, oh, I get that. I get this pressure. Like, you're just not okay the way you are. You have to be something that is okay. And in Germany, apparently Jewishness is okay. And I ended up meeting some converts who I mentioned in the article. I mentioned, for example, Hannah Zuberi, who's like a really interesting case for me because she's somebody who did a very serious conversion, an Orthodox conversion. It's very rare. Most people go for the easy conversion because it's fast and doesn't require you to learn anything or, you know, sacrifice anything. And she lives what you call the orthopraxy. Mm-hmm. She follows all the rules. She makes all the sacrifices. And the most fascinating thing for her about me is that she doesn't do it as much out of belief as out of respect for the cultural heritage and the desire to preserve it in a way that is authentic. And that to me was amazing. That to me is someone coming to my Jewishness and saying, I respect and appreciate it and I would like to contribute to it. Mm-hmm. And then I feel like this is beautiful. Like, I want this person to be part of my life. Like, I can learn from this person. I can learn from her perspective. And that's what I mean when I say, like, there are different ways, you know, to assume identities. And some of them are exploitative and some of them are enriching. And I think most people can tell the difference.
I wondered if that's why, like, part of the reason why you're, like, kind of really good at identifying, like, strange things about this culture is because you also come from, like, a background that...
I did feel... at some point in Germany that I was dealing with a kind of cult-like thinking, mm-hmm. Because it was so incredibly conformist and automatic. And I also felt when I started to speak up about it, I felt thrown back into my old role. Like when I first published Unorthodox and I was like, oh, I'm from this community and this is what they really do behind closed doors. Like, this is wrong. I'm going to point out the hypocrisy and like the way that women's and children's rights are violated and the way we don't, you know, get to enjoy our civil rights and we don't get an education and so on. I felt like, oh, I'm now the person in the cult that says something is wrong in the cult. Like, you know, this is
and
how
the
I felt.
The cult is Germany.
The cult is Germany. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. The cult is Germany.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think, you know, in your essay and also in some of your interviews I read, there's a sense of like living in Berlin used to be one way. It used to be a really great place to be. Like, it was a really exciting time in Berlin. And now you kind of speak with this kind of sense of the past tense or like loss. Yeah. Or like, do you really think that it's changed so much and like for the worse?
I think the people probably haven't changed, but all of the things about the city that made it attractive to these people, that, you know, the reason why we moved here, most of those things are gone. But I'm still hopeful that there's something left in Berlin. Berlin has always been a city of resistance, even when it has been conquered. Like, yes, Berlin has been put down for years and decades at a time, but it has always sort of risen up out of the ashes because it's indefatigable in a way. So, of course, I still believe in Berlin. I still have the people that I love in Berlin, but many people have left. There's not as much art happening because there's not as much support for the arts. You have this really crazy anti-Semitism, what do they call it, Subventionen, subsidy scandal, right? Because you know how Germany spends tons and tons of money on fighting anti-Semitism, right? And this is on top of the money they spend subsidizing the Jewish community or the sort of converted Jewish community. And the big scandal in the last few years was it turns out that all of the millions and millions of euros that were set aside for the prevention or the, you know, the battling of anti-Semitism was just being distributed to friends of the political party in charge of distributing the money. And it was not going through any of the checks and balances that it was supposed to go. You know, there's a jury that decides if the funding is going mm-hmm. to the right place and if the people who are getting the funding are actually doing something with it. And now they've just like frozen the funding because they realize that actually it's just people enriching themselves in the name of fighting anti-Semitism. And that to me is a really good practical way of understanding how German philo-Semitism works. German philo-Semitism works because it gives Germans impunity. They say they're fighting anti-Semitism. They are beyond criticism. They are beyond any kind of checks or balance. And then the end of the day, I'm a little bit astonished by the extent of the cynicism, because in the beginning, when you start to observe this, you think this is subconscious, this is psychological, this can be explained, nobody has malicious intentions, it's just a very neurotic, cult-like society. And then you realize it's not. It's people who are cynical opportunists who have realized that they can, in the name of Jews, accomplish things that they would not be able to otherwise. I mean, the climax of the essay is philo-Semitism as incubator.
Right.
For a new virus of anti-Semitism.
A new virus of anti-Semitism.
I'm talking about all this like normal freaky stuff, right? Yeah. The conversion. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, here's a convicted Holocaust denier who's been part of the official Jewish community for years. Here's like a whole system of like fake right-wing extremist Jews who've been part of official Judaism, like who say the Jews finance Hitler, but we're the real Jews. Like, This is where everything sort of goes into absolute Alice in Wonderland territory.
Yeah. And also you talk about the Matthias Döpfner.
Yeah, the hyper-Zionism.
As well,
yeah.
Like that Zionism über alles. I mean, it's also just like these people who are mostly men are just like violent edge lords, for lack of a better word. You know what I mean? Like, they would take anything that was taboo or provocative and try and like utilize it in a kind of power struggle that makes them like incredibly important. Is that too simple? Like, because my reaction, I'm making, if you're listening to this, I'm like making disgusted faces. You know what I mean? I'm like, what, like,
I think, I think the key word is violence.
Yeah,
we talk
right?
about violence, and that's exactly what it is for me. It is a violent act. When Matthias Döpfner, you know, transmutes the Nazi ideal of Deutschland über alles, Deutschland above everything, into Zionism above everything, to me, that is an act of violence against Judaism and Jewish people. It's an act of wresting control over the identity that feels analogous to something like rape or like violation. It feels to me as a Jewish person really personal and terrifying. And when I see the story of these Reichsbürger right-wing extremist communities consisting of Holocaust deniers and anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists allowed in by the Jewish community to become a part of official state-funded Judaism, to receive associated subsidies and the privilege and the capital and the power those subsidies bring with it. Then I think, why are Jews participating in this violence? Why are we submitting to it? Are we afraid that if we don't participate or submit, that we will be erased, right? That is a big question at the end of the first part of the essays. Like, will we become erased if we don't submit to the will of others for what Judaism must become according to their projections and wishes? Like, is that our only option left?
Are you sure it's not just, as you talked about earlier, like a cynical deal-making strategy that may or may not go terribly wrong?
There's definitely that.
Yeah.
There's cynical deal-making. But I think that, and this comes from conversations I've had with people within the system, I think there are people who genuinely believe that this is the best we can do. Like, it won't get better than this, and so we have to cooperate with freaks and weirdos and maybe also Nazis and extremists and people who technically really hate Jews but are willing to work with Jews so that they can access what they see as Jewish power and use it for their own ends. And you see that really concretely in the way the right wing in Germany has taken advantage of the political shakeup of the last few years to gain ever more power. And you saw that in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. was following the playbook of the Greens and the SPD when they were saying, like, oh, universities have to tell us how they're fighting anti-Semitism. We have to protect Jewish students on campus. It was the same playbook.
Yeah. And also I was going to say, too, about the U.S. or like the parallel with the U.S. is that we have cynical politicians and cynical, like, pundits, right?
Yeah.
Like, voice boxes using very charged narratives to convert people to their side, right? Like, they don't care, right? You know, one would say Donald Trump cares about anything. Certainly Donald Trump doesn't care about Israel, right? Like, I mean, maybe you disagree, but like, does he care about the Zionist project? No, of course not. But he's promoting this and then making millions of people believe in like the Zionist project, like who probably would never have cared. What can you do like about it? How do you fight it? It's actually a very difficult question, because I think being like pure and honest and left wing and sort of like genuinely reaching out and having conversations, I don't know that it works that well, actually, or you know, certainly not on a scale.
Both of those assumptions, I think, are true. I think it works and it doesn't work. People who communicate honestly in the way that Mamdani or Polanski communicate, they do reach an audience that appreciates honest communication. But if, just like there are many cynical opportunists in politics and in media, there are cynical opportunists who are voters, who kind of see the deal and they get it from the other side of the bargain. And they like the idea of being able to translate that political and medial power into their everyday social lives to bully people by using the accusation of anti-Semitism, especially people who are threatened by the existence of minorities in their immediate proximity. So, for example, let's say you work in an office and you feel like your colleague who has a migrant background might get a promotion that you prefer to have, but you're white and you're thinking, if I can just spread a rumor that, you know, she's pro-Palestinian, therefore she's an anti-Semite, you know, I probably will be able to convince the boss to be intimidated enough to give me the promotion instead. And that's how this operates, like in an everyday way, because for every cynical politician, there's thousands of cynical voters who are willing to play that game, even though they know exactly what the game is.
Right.
I am not interested right now in ways I can find common ground. I am interested in ways I can point out all of the flaws and failures around us. I want to resist and oppose. And so this is exactly why I am what I am. I'm not a politician. I'm a writer. And writers have to be comfortable with putting something out there that makes everyone hate them, as long as it makes somebody think. Mm-hmm. And maybe not now, maybe in 10 years.
But do you ever have moments of doubt about this? Or like, it's difficult to do that, right?
I think that if I look back in my own life and I think about the people who provoked me, like whose work provoked me, sometimes people will disagree with you very quickly out of impulse. They feel threatened. But something starts to sort of foment inside them. And I just think of all of the work that I've read that has put me off as soon as I've read it, but that has sort of stayed within me. And then years later, I'd come back to it and I'd be like, wow, yes, I get it now. And I think you believe in that. That's why you do what you do. I think you believe that maybe people won't agree with you right away, but they will eventually. Like someday they'll come back to that memory of what it is that you said or wrote, and they'll understand what it is you meant, and they'll take it further. Of course, it's unpleasant. Lots of things about this are unpleasant. And I've paid a financial price because I lost like a lot of my sources of income in Germany. And also like I had to start being careful because I had like death threats, people following me, and I would have people like approach me on the street and touch me. And like that was scary. Yeah. Like, but on the other hand, the truth is that I'm like a person with high social anxiety. Like I love to be holed up in my little space and not see people for long periods of time. I love to be alone with my books and all of my crazy elliptical thoughts. And it works for me. And the hate's somewhere out there. Like most of the time it doesn't reach me. And I mean, if you look at my trajectory, if you look at the story of Unorthodox and what a scandal it caused in New York when it was first published and how now it's like mainstream. I've done this before. I know how it goes. It's just, I think, how God made me.
Do you believe in God?
So there are these statistics. People try to analyze the reasons why Hasidic people leave their communities, because since I've left, there has been an enormous increase in the amount of people who've left. I mean, in all religious communities in Israel, in New York, in Europe. And one of the statistics, for example, will say that an almost overwhelming majority of the people who leave are men. Okay, easy to explain, right? Because they have an easier time. They have more independence. They're usually not burdened by children and so on. And then there's another really interesting detail that always astonished me, which is that men leave because they have a crisis of faith. They stop believing and they think, oh my God, I'm living a lie. I have to get out. And women never leave for this reason. Women leave because they don't feel safe, because they don't feel their children are safe. And they don't think about God until years later when they have time. And then they start to ask themselves, do I believe in God? So I actually never thought about whether or not I believed in God when I left. If anything, I thought God wanted me to leave. I thought he was helping me leave.
Why would he put me in this situation?
Right. Yeah. I was born into this very strong sensation of God being close by. And I think I can understand why. I'll just give you one example off the top of my head. My grandfather would come home every Friday night from the synagogue, and before he would start the meal, he would put his hands on the wall of our dining room and he would talk to God and he would cry. Like, it impressed me to see my grandfather emotionally vulnerable, to understand that God was the being with which he could be emotionally vulnerable, because he wasn't normally an emotionally vulnerable person. And I remember as a child, like, thinking it was normal to talk to God and feeling like God talked to me, and that he understood me, you know. And then later I felt embarrassed about that. And I kind of tried to teach myself to stop doing that, because I felt it was like a sign of my being provincial, you know, my being like the little girl from the cult. And in the last few years, I started talking to him again, also in a way that feels so self-conscious. And I feel like, obviously, from outside of myself, I can see that the reason I'm doing this is because it's my only psychological recourse. Because what else do you do when you see images of children being blown apart on your social media every day? Like, what else do you do but talk to the God that you've always talked to as a child? Like, of course, you regress. You go back to those instincts. It's just there's nothing else. And I remember I had been in like therapy for many years, just because I'm a New Yorker and therapy is like a purse.
Yeah, well, also it's like, you know, you don't want to develop like weird issues.
Yeah, but also I love it. Yeah. I was like, it's wonderful to have a therapist. I had found this really amazing therapist in Berlin really early on. I'd been going to her for like a decade, and I was just like, you know, it was the thing I did for myself. And I stopped going because I was like, no, actually, all of my anxiety and all of the ways that I feel are normal and healthy. And I'm not going to try to neoliberalize myself outside of that. And yeah, I've turned back, I guess, to the tools that the people who raised me gave me. And yeah, also the tools of religious belief that I think I use in a modern and independent way. I define, you know, like how I use them, and nobody tells me what to do and how to do it. And I have gained new respect for people who have chosen to live like a spiritual practice or a religious communal life, which is something I really didn't have before, by the way. Like, I really rejected people who lived religiously after I left.
Well, yeah, in that sense.
And I don't do that anymore, because I understand that if you are lonely, if you're isolated, if you are oppressed, if you feel like the world only wants to defame you and displace you, like, it can be great comfort.
Do you think that the events of like the last 6 months in the world, particularly with our home country, will change at all the German relationship to Israel and to Jews? Is there any political hope that Germany will change because of the accelerationist Donald Trump, right?
We do know that the relationship between Germany and Israel from the beginning was a very cynical one, right? It wasn't a sincere one. And I have never believed that Germany actually cares about Israel. I think, like, when we look at the pundits and the politicians, like, I think they still see an instrument of power in Zionism against internal threats, like the shifting demographics in Germany and the movement towards the left that we had before. And what I see right now, especially in terms of the war in Iran, is I see the eschatological myths of three religions converging in a very opportune time and place. And everybody involved is fighting this, you know, battle for their Messiah, for their end times narrative. And then you have the secular, you know, eschatologists, right? You have the Peter Thiel and the whole neo-reactionaries around the Trump movement who also have an eschatology. It's not a religious one, but it's a story about how history should be accelerated to the inevitable collapse so that, you know, something can come afterwards. And there's various different visions of what comes afterwards. But there really is a drive towards some kind of ultimate apocalypse and renewal. And I don't think Germany is going to play any kind of role in that at all.
No.
I don't think Europe is going to play a role. I think that Germany is insignificant politically. It's used to, you know, sun itself in the warmth of America and pretend it was something because it would go along with whatever America does. But as soon as it stops, it's just it's all for show. And of course, like we're headed for disaster. And what I can tell you for certain is that Germany will have a chancellor from the far right party relatively soon. And we'll have fascism again. And that's going to be interesting.
Well, you also say in your essay that Jewish life needs renewal and this can only come after a reckoning, right? Like, what would that look like to you? Are we in the reckoning? You say this is my reckoning right now. Are we in the reckoning?
I think we're at the beginning of something. I mean, I think when an Ariel Angel from Jewish Currents talks about building new institutions, she's talking about that. I think when American Jews are, you know, rejecting Zionism wholesale, they are having a reckoning of their own. I think when Jews protest being used as instruments or as objects, they're having a reckoning. I think when Jews protesting the way that Holocaust memory culture has become a tool for political agendas instead of setting an example for universalist human rights, that's a reckoning. I think all these things are a reckoning. And I think we have been weakened by complacency, and we have been weakened by ignorance, and we have been weakened by comfort and a willingness to look away and so on. But that's gone. That's gone. And there is real potential there, and it has to be harnessed. And people have to have what the Germans call den langen Atem, that long, patient breath, that willingness to wait, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's possible that there will be something else. I just worry about the cost. But everything has had a cost. Like, it will have a cost no matter what. So I'm still alive. And for as long as I'm alive, I want to work towards a form of renewal in whatever way I can, because that makes my life feel meaningful to me, makes it feel worth living, and makes me still happy to get up in the morning. I think that's the most we could ask for anyway from life. So whatever it is, whatever the price is that I'm going to pay down the road, like, it was worth it. Like, while we lived, we lived. We really lived. Like, if I look back at the people who've been through this before, generation after generation, like, what would you rather have? Would you rather have a comfortable, safe life where nothing that you did or felt or experienced meant something? Or would you rather have a life that was meaningful and that was part of something bigger?
One also sees, like, this, especially like right after October 7th, and you know, I'm reading a lot of like anti-Zionist Jewish, like, you know, Jewish Currents, like op-eds, this kind of stuff. And there was very much like a political impetus to argue that what was happening was bad because it was bad for Jews, because that the Holocaust could come again, not in Palestine, not with Palestinians, but with Jews, right? Like, what you're talking about is a reversion rather than a renewal. It could just, like, you know, the old anti-Semitism could just come back. Is it really productive to frame it that way when there are other problems?
I mean, this is what connects me to Palestinians. This is why you see Holocaust survivors at demonstrations for Palestinian rights. What has allowed me to feel empathy, understanding, solidarity with Palestinians is coming from a Holocaust background, being raised by people who went through it and who told me about it. So, of course, I recognize in them what Masha Gessen recognized in, you know, in Gaza. Like, I'm like, yes, like, we share an experience of what it is to be defamed by the world, to be marginalized by the world. And just because some of us are instrumentalized by people with evil agendas, you know, it doesn't change that for the majority of us, normal people of Jewish or Palestinian identity, there is no place for us. And, you know, the people duking it out with their fancy bombs and their AI military technology don't care about me, and they don't care about my Palestinian friend.
I guess I don't want it to be true that one needs a direct connection to this kind of suffering in order to feel empathy, compassion, righteous anger.
No, you don't
about
need it.
Right?
You don't need it.
No, and it cannot be true because
it just happens to be that I have it.
Yes.
But
yes.
You don't need it. And I have never thought about anti-Semitism in relation to Palestinians, never, because it has never occurred to me to frame what is happening in Israel-Palestine as an issue of anti-Semitism. So when I talk about anti-Semitism, I never feel I am making any reference whatsoever to the suffering of Palestinians, because they are very separate things. The only thing that connects Palestinians to anti-Semitism is the fact that they are being punished for the anti-Semitism of European nationalists, that they have been made to pay a price. But otherwise, I never, as a Jewish person, have felt that when I write about philo-Semitism or anti-Semitism or Judaism, that I am in any way making any kind of reference to Palestinian identity. Why would Palestinian identity always have to be connected or bound to Jewishness? It shouldn't. Like, historically, it wasn't. Like, why should it? Why can't they just be their own thing without it being drawn into every conversation about anti-Semitism or Judaism?
Because they're on the same land now. And not, you know, that's, I mean, that's literally why. It's like, I don't mean it in like a, it's a profound issue, right? Like, that's why they're
I don't see Zionism as Judaism.
Of course.
So I don't see the issue of Palestinians being in Palestine as being related to Judaism.
Yeah, of course.
I do.
I also don't say that. I'm just saying that
I know that some people say
the logic of the right. of the arguments.
So
right.
I think there are Jews who feel these arguments, you know, in their relationships with Palestinians, and they sometimes feel uncomfortable and they might want to compensate. But I have the luxury of feeling very comfortable in my anti-Zionist heritage. It's like I was born with it. It's mine. Mm-hmm. I claim it. I've never felt weird around Palestinians for that reason, because, like, that's not me. Whatever is happening there, like, that is not me. That is not my belief system. That is not my heritage. It's not my tradition. I care about Palestine because I'm a human being, and I care about Palestine because I'm Jewish, and I care about Palestine because I live in Germany, and I care about Palestine because I think it's true what they say, that in Palestine, the problems of the asymmetry are most naked.
Is there an argument to kind of like distance oneself from like terms like the Jewish community or the idea of a Jewish community, which is so not fractured, but like diverse, maybe a nice way to put it. But, you know, how can it be true that some people are like, well, you're not really Jewish because you are not a Zionist? While also, you know, you have the Tzamar community, which we were discussing earlier, they're religiously anti-Zionist for a long time, right? Like, no one would say they're not really part of the Jewish community. But when you say the Hasidic community in Williamsburg, that means a very particular thing. And I think what I was trying to get at earlier is, like, you know, when you say the Jewish community, like, it could mean, does it mean it's like you're not a card-carrying member, right? Like, also, many of the people in the German Jewish community aren't really Jewish. So, like, I wonder if, like, I don't know the answer to this, but these are questions that bother me in lots of different contexts. Like, what does it mean to be a woman? Like, da da da, or like, you know, whatever, all sorts of marginalized minority communities, right? People bristle at being like, I'm part of the, you know, LGBTQ community or whatever, the queer community. Like, what is that, you know? And I think here you know this.
Well, the
this
good
kind
thing
of
is
issue
that the LGBT community doesn't want its own state, so that's a really good place to start.
Maybe that would be fun.
Yeah, I don't think that's where we want to go. I think that like
they just want their own clubs.
We had that.
We just want our own.
It didn't work. Like, look, I want people who are Jewish or who feel Jewish or who feel not Jewish enough. I want them to see Jewishness as a source of joy and strength, and not as a source of fear. And a compulsion to violence. And I think that the difference between identity becoming violent and divisive and identity being joyful and comforting is when it crosses the line from individual experience, from cultural experience to a tool of political power and a justification for political goals. And whenever you hear somebody justifying any political move with an identity, we've crossed that line. We've crossed a line into an abuse of.
That's a great rule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it happens, you know, in all places and with all identities. And you know, we've had this debate about identity politics. People are like, oh, we need to stop identity politics, or we need to acknowledge people's identities. And I just think we're very black and white about it. I think that, for example, this whole debate in France with Laïc Cité, like you don't get anywhere by erasing people's identities, and you don't get anywhere by saying, I don't see color. Mm-hmm. All you do is you make people feel like they're disappearing, like they have no right to exist. But you also don't get anywhere in saying, for the sake of identity, we need to build walls. You know, we need to create a sense of us and them, and we need to fight wars and so on. And I talked earlier about the experience of faith as comfort being the thing that connects me to other people who draw comfort from their faith. And I guess that's where I see the hope in identity, because even though like faith is lived differently in different communities, it is a universal experience. It can't connect you to other people, especially if you look at the stories, how similar they are. I still believe we're not gonna convert the entire world to atheism. It's just never gonna happen, because I think the only way you could do that is give people such extreme levels of comfort and safety that they would have no need for the cultural and psychological comfort that religion provides. But since the world is such a fallible and also really miserable place for so many people, I think the best way to navigate the issue of identity right now is to try to find ways in which our identities intersect and share commonalities without watering them down or making the differences feel like hindrances or problems.
I guess a final question is, you know, you've been in Germany for over a decade. You came with great hopes for the, you know, diverse, free, radical alternative society that Berlin promises. And you know, now you have different ideas. Do you want to stay?
Do I want to?
Or do you intend? Do you like, want to? And do you
I don't really
to?
Want to. Like, life is not about the things we want. I mean, I'm going to be 40 this summer. Like, my life is very established. I'm very rooted. I have family. It's all very complicated. Do I want to leave? Of course I want to leave. It would be amazing to leave. Where would I go? I don't know. It's complicated. I think I will leave.
Really?
Like, I already spend so much time outside of Germany as is. I can see myself kind of slipping away. On the other hand, like, I hate Germany. So I really just do not want to do it the favor of going away.
And you have to go on a press tour about why you hate Germany and just drawing more attention to Germany again.
I think what we need to do is like we need to publish like an anthology where like all of the people who hate Germany write about how and why they hate Germany. Like, I think that'll be such a great like new like we'll call it like, you know how they called it the Roaring Twenties or whatever? Like, we'll call it the Hating Thirties. Like, we'll just, I don't know. No, I'm very highly motivated may I speak French?
Yeah.
To fuck this place up.
So you need to stay for that?
To an extent, yeah. I mean, you can do it from afar, but I gotta keep coming back and messing shit up, yeah.
That was Deborah Feldman. You can read Deborah's essay For the Love of Jews at blnreview.de. Please consider also subscribing to Berlin Review. Subscriptions start at just 5 euros a month at blnreview.de/abo. This episode was produced by Caitlin Roberts with Najla Saeed and recorded in the studio of Jacobin, Germany. I'm Lauren Euler, co-host of Airlift from Berlin Review. Thanks for listening.